8:30 a.m. KSDP Radio. I'm Kels Hetherington, and this is Meet the People for June 16, 2010. My guest this morning is Joe Miller. Joe is challenging U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski for the Republican nomination for U.S. Senate in Alaska. Well, thank you very much, Mr. Miller, for joining me on the telephone and making time in your busy schedule for this interview. How are you?
I'm doing well. Thank you for having me on the program.
No problem. Well, you're talking to the people of Sandpoint and King Cove. Tell us a bit about your professional background. I know you're an attorney and you've practiced law in Alaska. You've been a judge here and you're not new to politics. But why do you think that you are ready to take on U.S. Senator Lisa Murkowski?
Well, I came up to Alaska about 16 years ago. Excuse me for a moment. It started out in Anchorage, did some work on behalf of the state of Alaska on the royalty litigation. And then from there, kind of entered a transactional practice and got a little bit bored. I came up to Alaska out of the military after law school because I wanted to see the state, kind of wanted to enjoy what it had to offer. I grew up a hunter in rural Kansas, and I recall as a kid walking around hunting pheasant and quail, thinking about how it would be great to go up to the land where there's really big things to shoot. And that's what drove me up here. And so I spent a little bit of time in Anchorage, but felt like I wanted to see more of the state. There was a magistrate position that opened up in what some might regard to be the bush, although compared to your neck of the woods, not so much. On the road system, but the district itself covered a number of bush communities, rural communities. We had North Way, Mentasta Lake, Dot Lake, Eagle River, and spent, four and a half years acting as rural magistrate. I was also superior court master. Spent a little bit of time in Fairbanks while I was doing that. From that position, there was a U.S. magistrate judgeship that opened up part-time in Fairbanks. Applied for that, was appointed at the time the youngest U.S. magistrate judge in the nation. Spent a couple of years doing that, and then decided to get active in politics and ran a legislative race in 2004. That turned a lot of heads because it was almost an upset victory. It was a staunchly Democratic district. I ran as a Republican, received over 48% of the vote. From there, entered into leadership in the party and tried to make some changes, and then fast forward to where we're at today, running against Lisa. I should note also that during the time frame that I was up in Fairbanks, I attended the University of Alaska and received a master's degree in economics. My educational background prior to coming to Alaska, I was at West Point, graduated in 1989, and then went to the first Desert Storm, was involved in combat there with the 1st Infantry Division. I was an armor officer, received a Bronze Star during combat in that war, and then went to law school at Yale Law School in Connecticut, and then directly out of law school went up to Alaska. So really, after my military service and my graduate school work, my first stop was Alaska, and that's what we made our home. That's where my family and I live now and our children live.
Now, what makes you think that you can beat a sitting U.S. senator after not winning a Republican seat in the state House? I know you ran as a Republican, and you did almost win. You got 48% of the vote, but you're up against a very strong incumbent who is also a Republican. What makes you think you can be victorious in this situation?
No. That race was against a Democrat. In fact, the legislative race, and that's a fair question, too. I appreciate you asking it. The race in 2004 was against David Guttenberg. He's a Democrat. The district itself is the university district. It's in one of the top liberal districts in the state. And so, in fact, a lot of people said, Joe, what in the world are you doing running this race? I mean, Lisa Murkowski's sister, Eileen Van Wy, ran the race a couple of years or 4 years before that and got in the 20 percentile. What makes you think you're going to be able to win that? And I said, well, look, I run based upon principle. I know this is a very liberal district, but I think I have a lot to offer, and we worked it hard. We won our primary 70 to 30, something like that. It's all a matter of public record on the Division of Elections website. And then, like I said, almost pulled an upset. And the reason why that turned a lot of heads is because it was expected that, I'd score in the 20 or 30% range, just like everybody else had that ran for the Republican Party in this Democratic district. But shortly after that, I was elected the district chair of our party and then the regional chair from there. But this race is quite a bit different than that. We're running in a Republican primary. I suppose a good comparison would be the primary that I ran in that race where we won 70-30. Of course, I'm not under any type of misunderstanding about what kind of race we're in here. We're up against an incumbent established, good name recognition, lots of money from different special interests, and it's going to require a lot of hard work. But what we see in this race is somebody that more closely represents Alaskan values running for election against somebody that, by her voting record, reflects far differently on those Alaskan values.
What do you suppose differentiates you from Lisa Murkowski?
I think the fundamental difference is the way that we approach government. I look at government as being an entity, the federal government as being limited by the Constitution to protect our God-given rights. I think she, on the other hand, based upon her voting record, looks at government as the answer. Any time that you look to government and say, look, government, if there's a problem, the first stop should be what is government going to do for us, I think is looking in the wrong direction. My real concern today for the United States is grounded in the fact that we look at the federal government and we say that that is really essentially the end all. If, for example, we have a problem with health care, where do we go? We go to the federal government. We don't bother to look at the Constitution first and contemplate whether or not the federal government even has a role in that area. If we look at the economic situation, we say, oh, government has to spend more money in order to bail us out. I don't think that's the proper approach. I think what we have to do is start with the Constitution, which basically gives government its roadmap as to what it should be doing. And if we don't find the power in the Constitution that authorizes what the federal government is doing, then we say stop, all stop. That is not something government should be involved in. And I think it's especially important today to be cognizant of that, not just because I think your word should be your word, but also in with respect to that, I'm talking about the oath of office that you take to swear and uphold the Constitution, but also because of the insolvency crisis that we're in today. Anytime that you look to government for all the answers, there's money involved, and lots of it. You know, right now we're sitting on, as of last week, a $13 trillion actual debt load. Now, if you look at future obligations, and I'm talking about Social Security, I'm talking about Medicare, all the other future unfunded liabilities that we have out there, by some estimates, it's over $100 trillion that is owed. And I really think that not only, of course, is there a constitutional issue involved with that, but we also have an extreme situation with respect to the burden that we're putting on our children, our grandchildren, our great-grandchildren, and even our great-great-grandchildren. It is an extraordinary debt. It's not moral for us to be spending future generations' money. And I also think, and this is a major concern that drove me into this race, that any time that you have a debt load of this nature, you begin to subvert national interests to your debt. And there are a couple of real clear examples of that. I'll just talk to one. Taiwan, this past January, February, we are obligated under the Taiwan Defense Act to provide weapons to Taiwan for their defense. And yet, when Taiwan asked for F-16s, we rejected that, and we rejected it because we were concerned about what China might do with our debt. There were threats that were made by the Chinese military that if the United States goes forward with a sale of F-16s, that they'll dump their debt on the market. Already we see when we're selling our debt on the market, the Chinese are less aggressive in purchasing that debt. In other words, our Treasury is actually buying back debt right now. We're at a point already where we've got a lot of inflationary tendencies moving forward because of the fact that we've got not enough foreign creditors out there that have trust and faith in the full credit of the American ability to repay its debt. Well, but also because of other economic pressures that are hitting countries throughout the world today.
Okay, if you're just joining us here on 8:30 a.m. KSDP, I'm Kels Hetherington. This is Meet the People. I'm talking with Joe Miller. He is running in the primary against Lisa Murkowski for the Republican nomination for U.S. Senate in Alaska. You know, you talk about the $13 trillion that this country owes others, and it's easy to say we need to stop spending money, we need to get the budget under control. But if you were in the Senate, if you are in the Senate come sometime next year, what programs are you going to say this country no longer needs to fund in order to cut back on spending?
Well, I think there are a few things that need to be done first from the outset. I mean, for one, instituting a balanced budget amendment is critical. I'm not sure if you're aware of this or not, but in 98, the Senate defeated by one vote the balanced budget amendment that would have put an end to deficit spending. In other words, we would be nowhere close to where we're at today had that been passed. And so that has an impact on all programs, not just one individually. Other things that can be done to correct the insolvency issue, even before you look at specific programs, is taking back those unspent TARP funds. The Troubled Asset Relief Program has some money that's been repaid. That's sitting in an account. that I'm telling you, folk in D.C. would love to just grab and spend any way they want. But that's another way to address things. Now, as far as actual programs go, I really do believe that Congress ought to establish something akin to what we might call a sunset committee. And that would be a committee that scrutinizes federal programs to determine, you know, if they're necessary, where they can be cut. You, as far as specific issues, the czar layer of government has got to go. You're probably aware of the fact that the Obama administration has created what I regard to be pretty much a parallel government by employing, I think we're at 38 czars right now, and that really takes away the power of the Senate to consent. Right now they've got to consent to appointees, but not the czars. And I think that clouds transparency in government, but it also adds yet another layer of government when the federal government should be downsizing. Now, I think something else that ought to be done. Oh, go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, no. Continue on.
One of the other concerns that I have is, of course, the spending needs to be not just limited as to ensure that we don't have deficit spending, as I mentioned as my first point. But government spending also needs to be limited, I believe, to the rate of inflation. You know, and I think it was April, the deficit actually quadrupled from the April the year prior. And as of April, the government posted 19 consecutive months. We're now at 20 or 21 consecutive months of budget deficits. And so in order to stop that, we must cap spending to the rate of inflation. And that will require government to live within its means, just as, you know, Alaskan families are required to live within their means. Something else, as far as programs go, hiring on all non-essential employees.
Yeah.
And right now, the way we're getting out of this debt is we're hiring government employees. I mean, that is not the way to grow an economy. That's the way to kill an economy. We're taking from the producers to hire more government workers, increase government salaries, and the impact of that is, you know, maybe a short-term blip. You might see actually a slight diminishment of unemployment, but the ultimate impact of that to the economy is the death knell. That is not where real production occurs. It occurs within the private sector. That's what needs to be stimulated. You know, one of the ways to stimulate that is to remove the taxation rate right now, which in this country at the corporate level is the second highest in the world. It's almost like we're putting a sign out there that says, you know, the United States is closed to business, and then we scratch our heads and wonder why we're outsourcing all of this work to foreign countries, why much of what we now consume today is actually produced by entities other than Americans.
Sure.
You know, once these things start taking place, I think we need to start paying off our debt. You know, right now with that federal debt clock just continuing to go skyward, nothing being done to reduce that. I think that's another thing that absolutely has to be done. I'm concerned about the growth of entitlements. You know, that growth of entitlements, we've talked Republican and Democrat, and I am running a Republican primary. But frankly, the point that we're at today is a bipartisan problem. I mean, if anyone points their fingers at the Democrats and says it's all their fault, they're wrong. It's actually this huge amount of government growth, this deficit spending, this out-of-control focus on the government as being the answer to everything, has occurred not just under Democratic control of Congress, but also under Republican administrations. And we've got to reverse that. And one of the first points at which we do that is to say we as Congress are not going to authorize any new entitlements. Budget expenditure, that's another huge issue.
Let me jump in here, Joe, and ask you about, you know, you talk about not wanting to support expensive programs, and I'm curious what you would have done had you been in the U.S. Senate at the time that the TARP funds were being voted on and they were trying to rescue AIG. Would you have supported a rescue of the banking institutions in this country, or would you have said, let them fail?
Well, I think that's the wrong way to characterize it. I mean, it's not rescuing. That's propping up failing business. I mean, it's not a rescue. It's propping up inefficiency. Mm. And absolutely, had we not done TARP, I'm sure that there would have been much more of a slide at that time economically. But you know what we're in right now? We're in a long-term slide. All we've done is slowed and prolonged the decline. Anytime that you jump into private enterprise and say, look, we're going to come in and bail out what you've done, basically saying that, yeah, you've made bad business decisions, but, hey, the federal government's here to act as your insurance policy so that when you make bad decisions in the future, the taxpayers then come bail you out. What does that encourage? It encourages bad business practices. I sat there, you know, when that TARP bill got voted on, I was very vocal, at least within my circle, about how wrong that was. In fact, I knew that You know, at the time that we had some on the Republican side back, and that in fact was a Republican program, that for the, especially those political candidates that were running at the time, was a bad move, because I think all Americans, most Americans, saw it for what it was. That is, you know, bailing out businesses too big to fail. And that's not the American way. It's not capitalism. It's not the way that we should encourage performance and efficiency. And now where we're at today is you've got these huge corporations that view the government basically as their safety net. Doesn't matter what they do, they can continue to pay their CEOs tens, hundreds, the millions of dollars that they pay, unconnected or disconnected to performance. Instead, all they have to worry about is making sure that they've got the correct political connections so that when the time comes, if it comes, they're going to have that bailout provided to them by the federal government. And sure, short-term might have provided a little bit of a slowing, but frankly, where we're headed, it's inevitable that if you don't correct the fundamental economics of this country, that we're going to end up in a position as bad as Greece. Mm-hmm. And that would be catastrophic. So I'm hoping that just like in our race here in Alaska, other races throughout the United States, good, fundamental, political type that want to get back to the Constitution are going to be elected to draw back government to its limited role and restore a solvent government so that we no longer have to be dependent on our foreign creditors and we don't have to worry about this government debt dragging down the entire economy.
Joe, just a couple more questions for you. I know former Alaska Governor Sarah Palin has endorsed your campaign, and this is interesting, especially because SARPAC, the former governor's political action committee, made a contribution to Lisa Murkowski's reelection campaign. So I guess the question becomes, what made the former governor change her mind about which candidate to support in the Republican primary?
You know, I think that question is probably best answered by former Governor Palin. And in fact, I think she spent some effort in doing so when she stated her endorsement of my candidacy. There was a fairly detailed written statement that she issued that addressed the question that you asked. You know, at the time, and I'll just give you a synopsis as I understand it. At the time that she made the endorsement, that SARPAC made the endorsement of my opponent, there were rumors that, of course, Governor Palin at the time was going to run for that seat, and she wanted to basically undercut those rumors, say, look, wholeheartedly, no, I don't have interest in running for that seat. And, of course, there's also been subsequent development in the voting record of Senator Murkowski that I'm sure had an impact on Governor Palin's decision. But, again, I would direct any listeners that want, you know, the Governor Palin's words on that to go. I think she's got a Facebook page where that endorsement appeared, and, of course, it's been picked up by bloggers, too. So you probably do a search for Sarah Palin endorsement. Oh, one other thing. I think we've also got that endorsement on our website. If you go to joemiller.us, joemiller.us, just type that into your browser window and then do a search on our site. I think you can pull that up.
Again, if you're just joining us here on 8:30 a.m., I'm talking to Joe Miller. He is challenging Lisa Murkowski in a Republican primary for the U.S. Senate nomination in Alaska. You talk about Murkowski's voting record, and maybe that's why Sarah Palin may have decided to change who she was going to support. But you haven't given me, you know, a couple of examples of what Murkowski has voted for and where her voting record is problematic. Can you elaborate on those points?
Sure. Well, the problem is it's way, way, way more than a couple. In fact, her voting record is replete with examples of where I think true conservatives would substantially disagree with her position. I mean, we can look at the Wall Street bailouts. We talked about TARP just a moment ago. Representative Don Young, of course, voted against TARP. Senator Murkowski voted for it. Absolutely a decision that I disagree with. You know, she voted against showing a photo ID for voting to combat voter fraud. She's voted for amnesty for illegal aliens. She's voted for the Mexico City policy, which basically prohibited U.S. taxpayer funding of abortions overseas. She's made several other pro-choice votes that we disagree with. She, you know, says, and let me make this clear also to your listeners as I go through this list, the problem with Senator Murkowski's record is that she has voted consistently the way that I just described, but she's also had some votes on the other sides. And I think it's part of her design to make herself appear middle of the road. But frankly, it's inconsistent voting, and we're going to call it like it is. When we have, for example, two votes for amnesty, we're going to describe her as being in favor of amnesty. When we have a vote against requiring some sort of photo identification for voting, that's a vote against, our efforts to combat voter fraud. Cap and trade is another good example of that, where on the one hand, she made multiple statements in favor of cap and trade. In fact, made a statement a couple of months ago, I believe it was, where she said that she'd be willing to trade the opening of ANWR for some form of cap and trade. She actually introduced a bill or had her name on a bill in 2007, which is a cap and trade bill. Now, all of these votes, I'd like to remind your listeners, if you have any question about this, don't trust my word on it, go to the joemiller.us website. And what we've done is we've linked some third-party websites in based on the hyperlinks. Go to the candidate comparison, and where there are votes that reflect how she's voted, if you click on those votes, you'll go directly to those other websites, not our own, that reflect how she's voted. The Senate.gov website, for example, is integrated in that way. So it's not trusting Joe and mischaracterizing her record. Absolutely not. It's we're showing you where you can actually get that information. Not just cap and trade, but securing the border. She voted against funding the border fence. She's voted in favor of multiple new entitlement programs. She voted for Obama's federal hate crimes legislation. In fact, I guess just kind of as a synopsis, she's voted over 300 times with the Democrats against her own party on a variety of appropriations and other types of legislation that have come before the Senate. So this is not a close case of a conservative against a moderate. This is a case of a conservative against what we regard to be a liberal Republican.
Well, let me ask you one last question about big government. We're watching the oil spill in the Gulf of Mexico get larger and larger, or so it appears, and BP seems inadequately prepared to respond to this major disaster. Do you think that the federal government should step in and take over the cleanup effort and the effort to stop the oil from flowing out of this well?
Wow, that's a very good question. I think we've seen a complete failure of action on the part of the Obama administration there. To suggest that the Obama administration has some better ability than what BP has to clean that up, I think is highly, highly doubtful. I will tell you that it's very clear in my mind that this idea of a $75 million liability cap is just ludicrous. I believe that if you're engaged in drilling, that you've got to also incur whatever costs that are associated with that. If you spill it, you better pay the bill for it. That's a private enterprise view, too. This is not an anti-capitalistic, anti-development. It is purely economics. If you create a cost in what you do, you better make sure that you're taking care of that cost. And so what I'm absolutely supportive of is significant pressure to ensure that the entities that are responsible fully take care of it. I think it's very critical that liability limits be removed. Why should I, as a taxpayer, subsidize your actions? Now, that being said, I'm very concerned about the United States and its international competitiveness, not just on industrial production, but also in the extractive industries. And I think we've got to be very careful not to put up another sign that says, United States closed for business, yet again, in another area of development. The oil industry is critically important to Alaska. There's no question about that. But that does not mean we subsidize, particularly these entities that have had significant profits. But not only that, it's not the correct way to go about private enterprise. Private enterprise doesn't succeed by subsidies. And any time that you say the taxpayer is going to take up the bill for something that somebody else has created in the course of their business, it's a subsidy. But in the same way, we need to ensure that the government is facilitating responsible development. So I absolutely believe that BP needs to stand in the gap and take care of this and fully clean it up. The government, obviously, through enforcement, needs to ensure that that continues. But right now, I think the Obama administration has failed miserably in its attempt to help limit the consequences of that spill.
Well, all interesting comments. Thanks for joining us on the radio. Joe Miller has been my guest this morning. Anything else that you want to add?
Well, I just say that if you want to know more about the campaign, if you want to know more about that record that I just discussed, go to joemiller.us, joemiller.us. We have campaign headquarters in Anchorage in Fairbanks. I'm actually on the Kenai Peninsula this week. I got a number of wonderful supporters here, good support network there. If anybody wants to assist in establishing a presence in your neighborhoods and your communities, please contact the campaign again through joemiller.us, and we'll get somebody to you. We'll get information to you, and we'll help you set up your own Joe Miller campaign site. I really appreciate you having me on the program, and if, again, you'd like to talk to me about any of these issues in the future, I'd be happy to join you again.
Well, we will certainly call on you again, Joe. Thanks for making time for me this morning and the people at Sandpoint and King Cove. Thanks. Good luck in your campaign.
Thank you. Bye-bye.